Welcome to Saturday Miss. We've got just a few days now until the beginning of Passover, and you can choose to celebrate Passover, if you will, either at sunset on Thursday or on Friday. And there's a website now that is gaining a fair amount of attention that seems to be a blend of Rabbinic Judaism and of Pauline Christianity that is being critical of what I have said and what I've written. And they say that they won't name me by name. They will say that, you know, there are some that that says it does not matter when you celebrate Passover. And they will go on to say that if you don't celebrate on the right day, you're in violation of the law. And, well, here's the truth. Does it matter? Yes. You can't just choose any day you want. Yahweh has established a specific day every year to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. And by the way, to celebrate Pesach and forego Matzah is a terrible, terrible choice, because you would be made immortal, but you would still be imperfect, which means you would be eternally separated from God. That's a bad option. I've never said it's unimportant. I've never said it's irrelevant which day you celebrate it. But this is what I have said, and I think what I'm going to tell you now is irrefutable based upon Yahweh's testimony. Yahweh did not give us enough information for us to be dogmatic as to when Passover begins. He gave us enough information to choose the time of year with a reasonable degree, but not with absolute certainty. He said the time of the year would be Abib. And he established this because it was Abib when the first celebration of Pesach, Passover, occurred in Egypt. Abib is a Hebrew word that speaks of barley being ripening, but still being green and pliable. It was chosen as the term that Yahweh used to establish the time of the year that the first month of the year would occur, because barley represents souls that are part of his covenant. And so the chaff and the rest of the plant, the stalk of the barley, dries up and is blown away. It kind of becomes part of the cycle of life again. It's absorbed into the soil as nutrients for next year's crop. And so he uses barley because there's that separation. There's the good and pure kernel that has value and can be baked into bread, which is nourishing. And there's the part that is discarded and ceases to exist. So barley makes a wonderful metaphor for those souls who are part of Yahweh's covenant and those who are not. Barley is also the first grain to rise each year, so it establishes a timeline for the new year when the new crop of barley rises. The fact that the barley is Abib, which is green and growing, not yet hard as a kernel, tells us that this is a time of year when these invitations will appeal to those who are still receptive, and that those who are willing to grow in their understanding and knowledge and in the relationship with Yahweh. So it can't be the first month of the year, this month that we've been talking about in this program, can't be any month. It has to be Abib. And he also gives the reference to the flower on the flax, a blue flower, which is symbolic of not only the flax creating a linen and a garment of white that is symbolic with the garment of light that is enveloped, that we envelop when we become part of the covenant, particularly on Matzah, where we walk into Yahweh's light. And the blue is a symbol of both Yahweh and the heavens, where we will be transformed into spiritual beings. So the time of this first month of the year, Yahweh established in his testimony. You've got to make the connections. And then he's used Kodesh from the verb Kadosh, which means renewal, to speak of the time when the light on the moon's surface is being renewed. So it would be the renewal of the light on the moon's surface that is closest to the time when barley has risen, the new crop of barley has risen, and it is beginning to green and grow in the kernel. That equates to the renewal of the moon's light on the moon's surface closest to the spring equinox. That's just the bottom line there. Now, that being the case, the moon cycle is 29 and a half days long. And so determining which new moon is most of the time is easy, because there'll be a new moon within a week to 10 days of the vernal equinox, the spring equinox. Now, the spring equinox, of course, is a number that we use on the calendar because it correlates well with the barley rising. Now, you could be more literal, I would suppose, if you were to go to Israel and grow the strain of barley that was being grown 3,500 years ago, if you could find it, and if you could find a microcosm of Israel that was similar to the climate that existed there 3,500 years ago. I don't think you can in either case. But if you could, you would have the barley to check to see if it is Abib, green and growing in the kernel. Or you can realize that this essentially established that time as the vernal equinox and just find the new moon that's closest to that time. But precision then becomes a question mark as you deal with years where there's a new moon 14 days on either side of the vernal equinox. And then you have to choose which one. And on those years, you could be a month different than what Yahweh was intending, and yet you have no means whatsoever to be dogmatic and say it's this one, not the other one. God just did not provide you with enough information. None of us with enough information. So that's the reality. There will be years where you're dealing with a fairly equal spread of renewing light on the moon. Now, let's speak of between the vernal equinox. And the vernal equinox, by the way, is not mentioned. We only use it because it's the most constant denominator, the most reoccurring denominator about the timing of barley in today's world becoming Abib. Then there's the issue of Kodesh, and what is the first day of the month. And there are two schools of thought. One is called observational. The other one is called astronomical. There are places in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms where no less than Dode himself has a discussion where he is predicting the time that the moon's light will be renewed on the moon's surface. So that's astronomical. And there are really no instructions on how to observe this phenomenon. And since there are no instructions, it doesn't say from the Temple Mount, you are to look out and here are the conditions. You know, if there is a renewing light on the moon's surface of any amount prior to the moon setting, then we'll call that the first day of the month. And why do I say moon setting? Because, you know, on our timeline today, we use a different method of measuring time. Our days don't start at sundown. Our days start at midnight. And so you could have, on the astronomical means, a renewal of the moon, of the sun's light on the moon, but after moon set, which means you couldn't see it. But it would still be accurate astronomically. Now, God did not give us a means to differentiate between these things. Didn't say use one or the other. He didn't say what to do if your vision is obscured by clouds or some other phenomenon, or if you're looking over and in the west you have a ridge and the moon sets before the light begins to renew on its surface, but you just can't see it. But it would be above the normal horizon, say, if you were looking out over the ocean. He does not give you how much light has to be renewing on the moon's surface. For example, this year it's 0.1% before the moon sets. 0.1%. Astronomically, that is a new moon. That is the beginning of a new month. Observationally, you couldn't see it. So what are you going to do? You're going to celebrate Pesach on Thursday or Friday. If you want to be a literalist and say the light has begun to be renewed on the moon's surface before the moon set, such that the first day of the month, and you add the 14 days, and the day starts on at sundown on the 13th day, so the 13th day of the new month, and your celebration of Pesach would therefore begin on Thursday evening, you'd be justified in doing so based upon what Yahweh said. If you chose Friday evening, you'd be justified in doing so based on what Yahweh said. He did not give us enough information to be dogmatic. That's just a fact. So you can't tell for certain. And if somebody tells you that it's absolutely one day versus the other, they're pretending to be an authority on something that is their own determination, not obtainable through a careful study of Yahweh's testimony. There is no way to decide between astronomical and observational. God doesn't specify. And there is, and by the way, astronomical is observational. Our astronomical findings are based on our observations. So you then have to, I think through the process and say, all right, God did not give you a means to be dogmatic. And he actually tells us one of the most heartwarming stories in all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms of Hezekiah, where Hezekiah says, you know, we are so far away from the Torah. I want to celebrate Pesach as the Assyrians are bearing down on us, but we're just not prepared to do so. I need a 2-week extension. Can we celebrate it? But on the wrong day, 2 weeks late. And Yahweh said, fine. So that's the reality. Let's deal with it. Understand why. In a sense, Yahweh did not provide us with enough information to be dogmatic on the day, the exact day. I mean, you're, with exception of the rare month, maybe every rare year, maybe once every 27 to 33 years, kind of on that basis, almost a moon cycle of years, 29.5 years. Let's just use that. Every 29.5 years where you have renewing light on the moon equidistant from the vernal equinox. You could be off by a full month. But with that exception, you're only going to be off by a day. It's a question of how much light needs to be on the moon's surface before the moon sets for you to call it day, the first day of the month. Because everything is triggered from the first day of Abib. And I'm telling you here that even this discussion I'm having with you is not explained in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It doesn't say that the light has to be before the moon sets, but it just seems reasonable to go that direction. And it doesn't say observational, but at the time, observation was the primary means, although shortly thereafter, most nations developed the ability to predict the moon phases right about this period of time. So it was, you know, within 100 years or so of this time, predicting the beginning of the month was more common than observing the beginning of the month. And particularly, but you know, what happens during the high percentage of days where the western horizon is obscured? You can't observe it. If it's obscured at all, you're not going to observe it. And also keep in mind that a renewing light on the moon always occurs when the moon sets in the west shortly after the sun sets in the west. So you're always competing against the residual light of the sun. It makes it very difficult to see. It's the hardest time to pick up the slightest trace of light. Now, where full moons always rise as the sun sets, but on the opposite part of the sky, where the sky is the darkest. Now, all that being the case, we have to ask ourselves, Yahweh is fully capable of providing us with precise information if he wanted to. But he didn't. Why didn't he? And I think the answer is that Yahweh doesn't like to provide precise information on much of anything. What he wants us to do is to think through the process. He wants us to be observant, to collect information, and then based upon the information to form reasonable deductions from the information that's available to us. So we think through the process, and we're part of this journey of discovery. And along the way, we don't just think through the when, but that we also focus on the why. And Yahweh is exactly the same on the why. He doesn't say specifically, Pesach deals with making mortals immortal. He doesn't say specifically that matzah is about making imperfect people perfect. He doesn't say specifically that Bukurim is the celebration of our transition from estranged to part of Yahweh's family. He doesn't say specifically that Shavua is about being enriched and enlightened and empowered. He doesn't say those things specifically. You really have to think it through. And that's the reason why those who typically advocate a rigid date and pretend as if that date that they have chosen is the date that God chose, which is just not true, that they will miss the purpose. And I'm here to tell you that understanding the reason behind these and evaluating the evidence that Yahweh provided and making the necessary connections to go from being ignorant to knowing and from knowing to understanding is vastly more important than is correctly assessing the right date. Look at the results of Hezekiah. They didn't meet on the right dates. But they understood the purpose, and because they celebrated Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim with the right attitude for the right reasons, understanding why they were doing it, they not only had great fun doing it, and not only asked to be able to do it another week, but the Assyrians that were bearing down on them as the mightiest army on earth, coming up to the defenseless city, were wiped out by God. He protected his people. He delivered on the promises of Pesach, of Matzah, and Bukurim, because they understood why they were doing it, because they celebrated it from the right perspective. That's the lesson for us. We have Rob on the line calling in from Michigan. We have some questions on Passover, but before Rob, I want you to ask your questions. I want to ask you a few questions. Would you mind?
Sure.
All right. Why do you think Yahweh didn't tell us directly that Passover was about eternal life and that matzah was about perfecting flawed souls and that Bukurim was about being adopted into his family and Shavuah was about being empowered and enriched? Why do you think he just didn't lay it out for us and say that's what these things represent?
My personal opinion is I don't think he wanted us to become religious about it. I mean, that's just my thoughts.
Yeah.
He wanted us to be aware of it and what it means, but not necessarily follow a certain order. You know, that brings religion into the mix when you start following. And it's kind of like the pork situation, you know,
Yeah. And
not eat pork or not eat anything unclean. He just didn't want us to be religious about it. That's my personal opinion. But.
Yeah, I think it goes one step beyond that. I think you're right that people would, if you created a very succinct roadmap that says you need to do these things for this reason. You would have religions around those things. That's correct. But beyond that, you would truncate the very thing that Jan was trying to culture. He wants to spend eternity with people who are interested in discovery, who enjoy the process of learning, who will be fun to spend a millennia with, out exploring, out having conversations with. And if somebody is just given, here's step 1, 2, 3, and 4, they're not going, most people are not going to dig any further. They're just going to say, okay, that's what I need to know. I mean, so many people have written me. Robin said, why don't you just tell me what I need to know, summarize it, you know, on one page of paper. I don't want to have to read 5,000 pages.
Yeah.
And so the reason he didn't do it is because it frustrates the intended purpose, which is to cull out from billions of people the thousands who are fascinated by, who enjoy, who literally think that the process of learning so as to know and thinking so as to understand is a fun, valuable, entertaining pastime. That's who he wants to spend eternity with. So I think that's the reason he didn't lay it out that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's what keeps me studying, basically, is, you know, just not having to lay it out for sure. You got to spend time learning about it and trying to understand it.
Does Yahweh ever, in his presentation of the covenant, does he ever say, here are the 5 terms and conditions of the covenant, and here are the 5 benefits of the covenant. Here they are, 1 through 5. This is what you need to do. If you do these things, then you're part of the covenant, and here are the 5 benefits. Does he ever lay it out like that?
Not to me, he doesn't. I mean,
no, he doesn't.
I've got to basically, you know, trying to understand what he's getting at when he's laying them turns out, you know.
Yeah, what you have to do is you have to read the book of Bereshit, the first book in the Torah, and you have to go through the request that Yahweh made of Abraham. You know, Abraham is the model for the covenant relationship. You have to say, what are the requests that were made of Abraham? And those become the conditions. And then what did Yahweh promise Abraham as a result of him agreeing to those conditions, accepting those conditions? Those become the benefits.
Yep.
And then it's really interesting, because then what you can do is you can associate the benefits of the covenant with the first 4 mikrei. And you find out that when you overlay the benefits of the covenant with the first 4 moed mikrei, Pesach, Matzah, Bekudim, and Shavuah, you find an absolute fit.
Yep.
Each of the benefits of the first 4 mikrei provide the benefits, the promised benefits of the covenant.
Yeah. Dress rehearsals.
Yeah. So there you go. It's all laid out for us. It's just that you have to do some thinking to get there. And the thinking process is predicated on accurate information, is it not?
Yeah.
And can you have accurate information to contemplate if you're reading a religious translation where the words and names are deliberately changed?
No, not at all.
No. So you got to start at the beginning. You got to start to what words did he actually use, and what do those words mean? And then from that's the foundation. From there, you got to go to make the connection so that you transition from being ignorant to knowing, and from knowing to understanding. And once you understand, you're in a position to exercise free will in a reasonable way. Well, thank you for playing along anyway and answering those questions. But you called with some questions. Let's address some of those.
I've been. This is going to be my first Passover that I actually planned for and was able to, you know, take time off and really, you know, basically get into it. And so I've been studying the last, you know, week or so, just really trying to understand what I'm going to be doing here. I had a couple questions.
Okay. By the way, you've already accomplished the mission, I think, that Yahweh laid out in his invitation. The very fact that you said this is the first time I'm going to answer this invitation and make an attempt to understand what I'm doing, and that you have devoted yourself to reading the material and understanding what it all means, tells me that you are doing exactly what God wants. Now, if there's a nit here or a question beside that, I'll be happy to try to address it. But you're already there, my friend.
Well, I'm glad to be here, to be honest
with
you.
Yeah.
It's amazing. One thing I wanted to ask was, it's not necessarily about Passover, but matzah, the unleavened bread.
Yes.
I know we're gonna eat lamb, we're gonna eat unleavened bread for Passover, we're gonna have some wine. I've been invited a few people.
Which means that Passover and unleavened bread are inseparable. You begin eating unleavened bread on Passover, which makes Passover part of unyeasted bread, does it not?
Yes.
Yeah.
For the 8 days.
That's really important.
Mm-hmm. That follow, though, that was my question was, are we to remain eating unleavened bread for the next 8 days?
Yeah, the question is it 8 days or 7 days in total? And there are people can interpret the instructions that Yahweh provides either way. I view this is my personal conclusion in studying the words, and I'm not claiming that I'm right. I'm just telling you that, and I'm telling you that there are very thoughtful individuals who disagree. But I think that it's 7 days of eating unyeasted bread, because I think that Passover is the first day of unyeasted bread. And so, personally, I forego yeast for 7 days, beginning with Passover. Now, you can, if you think that the answer is, and you're better served to eat unyeasted bread on Passover and not count it in the 7 days, and then eat unyeasted bread starting on matzah again and eat it for 7 days, and so you have 8 days of unyeasted bread, I'm not going to argue with that. But
during this time of the 7 or 8 days, while we're eating the unyeasted bread, are we to eat lamb the next 8 days, or is it just the bread that we have to?
Well, actually, it does. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what I do, and what I do is probably inconsistent with the Torah. It's not in violation of it by any imagination, but we are told to eat lamb on that, encouraged to eat lamb on that first day in remembrance of the role of the sacrificial lamb at the affirmation of the covenant with Abraham, and again 2,000 years later, 40 Obel on Mount Moriah, when the diminished manifestation of Yahweh fulfilled Pesach. And so there's no question that on Pesach it's lamb. But at the end of Pesach, the end of that night, you destroy the uneaten parts of the lamb. They're incinerated in the fire.
Right.
So you would then have to have a new piece of lamb the following day, and there's no instruction on that, because the lamb only makes the sacrifice one time.
Right.
So do you need to eat lamb the other days? Absolutely not. Personally, I like lamb, so I have lamb more times than not during the 7 days, but that's not based upon Yahweh's instructions. It's based upon my personal affinity for lamb.
I've never eaten lamb other than a euro, so.
Okay, yeah, I like lamb. Lamb chops are my favorite, and rack of lamb would be my second favorite, but, oh man, yeah, I really enjoy lamb. But no, you can eat whatever other meats or whatever you want to on the remaining days of the celebration of Pesach Matzah.
And there's one other question I had. He paid the price for us in Sheol.
Right.
Okay, for our souls.
His soul,
And now my question is this: if you're not a false prophet, then you wouldn't have to ransom the soul for you, would he? I mean, if you just ceased to exist, say if you didn't know Yah at all or didn't care about him and his Torah, then.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never even thought about that. But your point is that since most people wouldn't be headed to Sheol, because most people are simply deceived. And as being deceived, there is no visitation incarceration, if you will, in Sheol. It's only those who are deceivers, whether they be a false prophet, a religious leader, a priest, a a pastor or a academic person who is leading people astray or a politician or anything like that. Right. So if you're not actively leading people astray, then you wouldn't be going to Sheol, so you're not being ransomed for Sheol. Now, that's an interesting thought. Let me tell you why I think it's still important. I was headed to Sheol. I was engaged as an evangelist.
Right.
I was very active politically. I was extraordinarily pro-military. I was a patriot. I was headed to Sheol. Now, I stopped those behaviors, all of them, and distanced myself from all of those things when I came to know the truth. So I'm no longer in violation of them, but I absolutely was. I am really glad I have been ransomed from my past.
I would probably be accused of the same thing, I assume.
Yeah.
I unknowingly was a Christian, or one thing I'm proud of is I was a bad Christian, because I always questioned it even when I was a Christian.
I had a period of time where I didn't question it, and then a period of time where I did question it, went from Christian to agnostic. But in your case, perhaps, in my case, absolutely.
Right.
I needed to be ransomed. I was working for the wrong side.
I appreciate the time you spent with me.
Sure. And you can stay with us over the break if you have more questions. But thank you for working along with me through that segment. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. In this introduction to Pesach in Shemot, the names, Exodus 12, 1 through 4, Yahweh asks the children of Israel, while they're in the crucible, to bring in a lamb into their households on the 10th day of the month, but yet he says that Pesach, Passover, is on the 14th day of the month. Why do you suppose, Rob, that he wants the lamb to arrive within the home on the 10th day of the month?
And we were actually just talking about this yesterday. I believe the reason was he wanted us to, first of all, become familiar with it, mm-hmm. and then understand what it was to lose that lamb or to have to slay that lamb. I mean, the children would play with
right.
it.
Right.
They'd have, then
exactly.
they'd take it on. They'd have to watch their dad, you know. Slaughter it,
yeah.
And I don't know. I assume it was like losing something.
Yeah,
and
because what Yahweh was trying to convey here is that he himself paid that price.
Yeah,
he wants us. He walked into Jerusalem 4 days before Pesach, Passover, in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, and he wanted the Israelites to become familiar with him.
Yep.
And he wants all of us to understand what he himself is sacrificing, the price that he himself is paying to enable us to become immortal and perfect. So I think that's the reason why he's having a lamb come into the home 4 days before, is for that reason. Today, is it legal for you to bring a lamb into your home and 4 days later for you to slit its throat in front of your family?
It depends. I imagine if you lived on a farm, you might be able to get away with it, but I don't know about...
Yeah, if you did, you might. I think that in most communities, you would be breaking a number of laws if you did it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that even those who would be dogmatic about the timing of Passover or about the timing or the what you can and can't eat, bring a lamb, a live lamb, into their home or apartment... 4 days before Pesach, and then slit its throat in accordance with the Torah's instructions. So what that proves, I think, Rob, is that it's not about the doing. It's about the understanding.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, you'd probably be charged with animal cruelty or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I had another question about the 8 days,
sure.
or the 7 or 8 days. Are we supposed to restrain from working during them days?
No, there's really 2 days that are Shabbaton, that are days that are set apart to be celebrated as if they were a Shabbat.
Right.
If you are like the majority and are recognizing that the beginning of the month of Abib was only 0.1% of the moon's light when the moon set on the first day, and that that's really too thin, and are going to celebrate it on beginning at sundown on Friday, then the Shabbaton, both Shabbatons are going to fall on a natural Sabbath.
Right.
And so it doesn't change anything.
I'm going with the Friday, but I was originally going with the Thursday. I tried to look at the moon and determine for myself, but I really couldn't judge it, I guess.
Yeah, I think, even though I've said I think I'm going to go on Friday, I set a standard. I don't want to be arbitrary about this. I want to be as precise as it can be. And the standard that I set was if there was a meaningful amount of light on the moon's surface as the before the moon set, that would be the first day of the month. 0.1% is right there at the cutoff as to whether that's reasonable or not. And so I'm going to feel equally good about Thursday or Friday. The advantage, of course, of Friday is that it puts the Shabbatons on a natural Sabbath. The advantage for me of Thursday night is that it's wholly consistent with a precise reckoning of things. And if you're going to err, precision is knowing that Yahweh is precise is probably the best way to go. But if you're Friday evening, you've got a natural Shabbat. That's exactly what happened, by the way, in your 4000 year on 33 CE. You had Pesach began on Thursday evening and concluded, well, actually it was on Thursday evening, concluded on Friday evening at sunset. And then you had the Shabbaton fall on a natural Sabbath. So you have the opportunity to do the same thing this year. And it's your call, I think, really, so long as you're thoughtful about it, to do it either way. But, Rob, my friend, you are already there. You're well home. And so now this will be just a celebration.